some people, we didn't pick up exams yet. Julie, Rose, Haley, F-L-U-H-A-R-T-Y, are you here? No? She girl. All right. Eric, P-E-R-E-Z-A-K. Edward, Han, are you? Yeah, Edward, yeah. Jones, ready? These are some of the quizzes that we had over. B-H-A-R-A-T-H. Drew Hardy. Drew. Just what I want to increase my paper. Sam. K-H-A-N-A-L. Nevada. Nevada here. Laura Simp. No. And we have Eric. Erica. Great. Well, Bill Nye, the science guy, we had a movie showing yesterday. And why I bring this up is he gave a really good, it was a really good movie about his life generally. And it's not a total tangent because in the movie he talks about his family members having ataxia. His brother and sister all have ataxia, and he didn't do all the testing to find out if it's genetic or not. But he went through the testing. It was really neat in the movie of how he was being tested with his hand and being able to move a cursor, being able to walk and move his coordination. But his sister is pretty debilitated from it. And in the movie, he actually kind of comments about how lucky he was. And he's having like this guilt complex because why doesn't he have the disease and his family members did? And one thing that he actually said in the movie is because he knew it could be potentially genetic, he didn't wish to carry on those genes. And that's one reason he didn't have kids. So a pretty sensible guy in many ways. But it was a really good movie. In case you get to see that sometime down the line, I really highly recommend it. It's really good. About the science, too, and about motor coordination, you actually see some people being tested in that movie with motor coordination. So really cool if it comes out again. But maybe they'll show it again on campus. It was free because we PBS gave it to them for free. So that's kind of cool. All right, so we have quite a bit to go over today. Some fun things too. So remember, has anybody posted yet to Canvas your report, your abstract, little summary? Remember, that's coming up. It's going to bite you real soon because the deadline's coming up right before spring break. You want to try to get that in. And the lecture assignments there. There are so many cool things out there. Just to kind of give you a reminder again. Look at Journal of Neuromuscular Diseases. There's a whole journal just on neuromuscular diseases, right? Isn't that cool? I mean, just specializing in neuromuscular diseases. So you can look through there and look at the topics that they cover. Duchenne muscular dystrophy, for example, right? And, you know, different cellular activities that are going on in the cell. It's just amazing what's out there. And then you look at other aspects, you know, Journal of Neuroscience, or Neuroscience came out. This is a European journal. All kinds of neat things. Here's what we talked about before. Remember volume transmission? It wasn't just synaptic transmission from nerve to nerve or target, but you know, influencing neighboring cells, right, by being releasing chemical. Here's an article on volumetric transmission and some very important areas that we'll talk about when we get to behavior. The amygdala is your fear response in your brain, where you fear things, where you learn to fear like red or something dangerous. And so that's kind of really interesting, too. Just so many. And, you know, Trends in Neuroscience is a really good review. Journals, they come out all the time. Look at what we talked about in the labs last 2 weeks ago about barn owl. You know, here's an article on the barn owl about hearing, right? We talked about the hearing, the differences in the ears. If you went to the labs, maybe. Anybody remember that? All right. Hopefully I'm not dreaming that I talked about it. All right. Could be telling. All right, so many neat things out there. That's why I want to just encourage you to start looking at these. And remember, you can go to the table of contents of any of these journals and then just sign up and you'll get a table of contents, just like Science Daily. and then just get you all excited about the science that's coming out, you know, all the time. And then it makes you wonder, wow, how do I get involved in doing things, right? And like Bill Nye, the science guy, was saying in the movie was, you know, what he really thought his goal was to make the world a better place by doing whatever he could to advance science, advance and help the world as a whole and population. So pretty cool. So, you know, think about things that you can do to improve the world, right? So where did we leave off? We kind of gave a real fast summary that where you should have this in your mind. Let's go through it again, and then we're going to hit the next part. Nerve terminal, muscle, skeletal muscle, right? Action potential comes down the nerve terminal. What does it do that's different at the nerve terminal than just the action potential? What opens? Voltage-gated calcium channels. Calcium comes in, vesicles, spine, right? Release transmitter, all that process involved there. Then think about that calcium again. Does it hang around? No. It gets pumped out quickly. It gets exchanged out quickly. Binds to calcium binding proteins. Goes in the mitochondria. Goes in the ER. Right? Comes out slowly. But basically, it can get it down. If you repetitively stimulate, what happens? Residual calcium. More vesicles fuse even the second time. More than additive responses can happen. So more transmitters released, right? And then, let's think it's your neuromuscular junction, or the frog neuromuscular junction. Goes across the synaptic cleft. That's acetylcholine. What happens in that synaptic cleft? There's something magical in there. An enzyme.
Acetylcholinesterase,
right? So it's like chewing it up like a little Pac-Man, just eating it away, you know, all the time. But something gets crossed, binds to receptors. What type of receptors are those? Nicotinic, cholinergic receptors, right? Those are ionic channels, opens up. Sodium rushes in, goes down the concentration gradient, down the electrical gradient, right? Electrochemical always. A little bit of calcium comes out as well. So these two ions are moving. And basically, if you release that transmitter onto the acetylcholine receptors and you were able to patch those acetylcholine receptors and you opened it up with acetylcholine, it reverses around 0 millivolts. It's some of the textbooks that's a little confusing to students over the years. But basically what that is that if you allow those channels to open up, it will go to 0 millivolts because sodium's going in and potassium's going out. And that's where it's reaching its equilibrium, basically. Some books say about -5 or -10, but around there, okay? That's because it's not just sodium, like an action potential. It's not just potassium, but it's the two ions together. So it's a pretty big receptor ionic channel, right? And the first one that was crystallized by the torpedo electric fish, where they actually could take that off the muscle, the modified muscle, and actually crystallize. That was the first receptor that was X-ray crystallography to get the structure, which is very important for us. And then we go to the target cell, right? The muscle. Acetylcholine, graded response, right? Graded. And if you get enough of them, graded. Reach a threshold, right? This is skeletal muscle in mammals and frogs. You have an action potential in mammalian and in your in an amphibian, your preparations that you've worked, muscle fibers to fire an action potential. Boom, action potential. Travels along the plasma membrane, just like the nerve, right? It goes down, what we're going to be talking about later in skeletal muscle with these figures, it goes down the T-tubule, which is really just an invagination of the plasmalemma, the membrane of the cell. So these T-tubules go deeper into the muscle. Now, think about if you looked at different muscles, different animals, muscles that are really thin, like a single cell that doesn't have a lot of different muscle fibers all around it, would you expect a T-tubule? But when the muscles start to add many myofibrils together and it becomes thicker and thicker and thicker, you can't get the calcium to go down into the contractile elements, right? In some of the processes that we're going to talk about. So actually, you see these T-tubules invaginate into muscles that are really thick and bigger muscles across the animal kingdom. So it's really quite a neat comparative aspect. Down the T-tubule, there's a particular protein in the plasma membrane. So remember, that's plasma membrane. It's called a dihydropyridine receptor. Why is it called that? It's because dihydropyridine binds to it. It's a pharmacological agent. So they just call it that. Okay? But it's really a voltage sensor. Some textbooks show that to be a calcium channel, that calcium can come in. But most studies today now show that really in physiological conditions, that dihydropyridine receptor doesn't really allow calcium to come in. So it's kind of textbooks that might be a little bit funny on that. But then So it's a voltage sensor, like a voltage-gated sodium channel, in a sense, but it's not an ion channel that's going to normally work under physiological conditions. So it changes its conformation. Inside the cell, there's another protein that's bound to it. This is the general idea today. That other protein that's bound to it is a ranidine receptor, and they call that ranidine because ranidine binds to it. All right, and then it's attached to an intracellular organelle called the ER, or in muscle, we call that the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? It's basically the ER that you're familiar with in other cells. Inside of the ER, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, is calcium, high concentrations of calcium. So if it pulls on the ranidine protein, it opens up like the bathtub plug and allows calcium to dump out. That calcium dumps out, what does it bind to in the skeletal muscle? What's the protein we have to remember?
Starts with a C.
Or it doesn't start with a C, but it has C attached to it. Troponin C, right? Conformational change on troponin C opens up then, if the conformational change again, key words for biology, and then it exposes an active site on the actin. So if this troponin C is here, binds calcium, opens up an active site on the actin, and then what's waiting for that active site?
Myosin.
The myosin head. And as soon as it sees that active site, it's going to bind, and it's going to ratchet, and then how does that myosin head come off?
ATP.
It needs ATP. So this is the point that we went over about ATP. The myosin head can come off, it will rotate back. As long as the active sites are exposed, like the next one, you know, it's ratcheting, it's just going to keep binding and keep ratcheting. How do you stop that from happening? How do you stop the sliding filament from happening? Hide the active sites. How do you hide the active sites? Take calcium away, right? So calcium is being pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, back into the ER. There's many pumps on the ER that pumps the calcium back in. And so it's pumping the calcium back in, then there's no more bound to troponin C. It can then hide the active site, and the myosin head has nothing to bind to. Okay? And then you get muscle relaxation. But you also need the nerve to stop firing too, right? So that it's all working together. So you should be able to work that through your mind. The best thing to do is to take a blank piece of paper, write it all out, and like you're answering an essay question. Because you'll probably see parts of that broken up into short answers relatively soon, right? So, hint, hint, right? Because that's just so fundamental. Okay. So, hopefully we've got that down. This is how this, what we went through. But if you put that concept together, then all this makes sense, right? Because you need ATP for the head to come off. So, if you're not breathing, you don't have any oxygen, what happens? You don't make ATP, and your muscles get really stiff because the myosin heads are bound to there, right? They can't come off until your muscle starts to break down. And then once it starts to break down, then it's degrading, and then your heads come off of that. Okay, so that's pretty cool. Oh, yeah, I wanted to mention one other thing real fast. Ooh, let's go back to the inbox. As I mentioned, there's this muscle group on campus. And there's a muscle seminar at 11, if you want to skip that out of here. You know, we've got 15 whole minutes. And then over in, I think it's, where is this? They moved it this year. MDF, so that building that's next to us across the parking lot, we're right across this parking lot, across Euclid. And Tim Butterfield's talking about massage therapy and his grant that he got. And I mentioned about mechanoreceptors that are in muscle, right? And they think that it's very important for that muscle to keep it healthy, but also the idea of exomes being released from muscle that's being used, and they think there might be a relationship in there too. So all this is new stuff. It's really quite cool. So there's another seminar on this topic, so if you're interested. All right. So let's keep going on some of this. We're going to try to wrap up the skeletal muscle chapter a little bit, but let's just kind of rehash then. So the action potential comes down, right, into the nerve terminal, and then in mammals, most skeletal muscles, and in the frog, you can get an action potential in the skeletal muscle. But a number of invertebrates models do not make action potentials in the muscle fiber. They're graded. So there's some differences. Don't get confused. And then it takes some time for muscle tension to develop, right? Because of all those other processes that we talked about. So there's a little delay. But how fast can that happen? And how fast can muscle be contracted and relaxed? That's kind of neat, too, to think about. Well, to understand these processes, the early people actually did something like you did in your first lab. They actually could vary the potassium concentration in this pipette and kind of go across the muscle, and they would find different regions where you'd get local contraction. But they could also do other experiments too. They took this kind of electrode and they electrically stimulated at low voltages, not enough to induce an action potential, and they could see local contraction here, but the whole muscle wouldn't contract. But if they went too high, then they would get muscle contraction. So the early experiments, they were testing along the muscle what made it contract. And basically, they found some really neat aspects. As you depolarized, then you got the steep rise in muscle tension to develop. So they knew that was a threshold response right there, and that's pretty cool. But there was something that they found out. Around the Z-disc is where they got those local depolarizations. This is where the plasma membrane invaginates and makes that T-tubule. So this is that whole point. And this is where the dihydropyridine receptors are. So the dihydropyridine receptors are down in these T-tubules, which then are connected to the intracellular organelle, the sarcoplasmic reticulum, that holds that calcium. So there's the sarcoplasmic reticulum. Remember, this is inside the cell. So people get confused sometimes on exams, multiple choice questions like, where is this? And they say outside or something, you know. So this is inside the cell, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. T-tubule, dihydropyridine, granazine, open up, calcium dumps out over the contractile elements. Okay, multiple pictures to try to get an idea. You can imagine if you stain that muscle from mitochondria, active muscle that's really active all the time, what would you anticipate? A lot of mitochondria, right? And that's exactly what you get when you stain up muscles. So try to keep this kind of in your bigger picture. A lot of people did really neat work with understanding muscle contraction. They even looked at calcium indicators. We talked about that, like in the squid axon. You could do lots of different things with imaging technology, but just the idea of understanding what goes on in the cell. So this is just showing what happens when that muscle is contracting locally, for example. And so what you see here is the action potential in the muscle. So this is in the muscle. So you see the action potential first, and then the calcium loads, right? So that's pretty neat. And then after the calcium loads up, what did it do? It bound to all the troponin C, allowed muscles to contract. But that took a little time to develop that tension. So now you see the force in a longer time period, right? But how fast can this happen? How fast can you move your muscles? Is there a limit? You know, how fast can you do that in other animals? So this is what's really cool to look at. In that T-tubules, and you can see the T-tubule a lot better here, going to the endoplasm, the sarcoplasmic reticulum. But think on this membrane, a whole bunch of calcium pumps. Tons of calcium pumps. So when calcium, when this pulls and drops out the calcium, it can be sucked right back up in there really fast, right? So that's going to have to contract and relax. That element of how many pumps are on that membrane limits the rate of muscle relaxation and contraction again. The faster muscles that can beat fast and relax, you can stain them up and you'll find more of these pumps, calcium pumps. They're called SER, the sarcoplasmic endoplasmic ATPase-dependent pumps. So ATP is required to pump that calcium in there. So ATP for the myosin heads, right, all that good stuff, but also to pump the calcium back in there. So it's really neat. And here's a diagram of this, basically. You see the T-tubule, dihydropyridine receptors, ranitidine receptors, like the bathtub plug. Calcium comes out, and here's all these pumps, just waiting to pump it back into the membrane. Just think of all those pumps, just pumping it back in, okay? So that's just kind of a schematic to it. And we talked about what they call these contractile elements and then kind of that passive tension that we talked about. If you just stretch a muscle, you get passive tension. What does the general idea for that passive tension do to, again? Just to kind of refresh your memory. Tighten, the biggest protein in your body, right? And the connective tissue that's in there. You've got the plasma membrane, you got collagen, you got the fast muscle connective tissue around the muscle. So there's, you know, parts that give rise to the passive tension too. But Titan helps keep all that together as well. And then you think about disease states that we talked about, like muscular dystrophy, the dystrophin, all the protein complex that's holding the muscle together. There's a lot of proteins involved. All right. So here, if we look at these rates of stimulation, like we talked about, rates of stimulation, single twitch, you stimulate the muscle. This is tension measured in the muscle. All right, so it's your force transducer. Single stimulation, you got to twitch. Repetitively stimulate at low frequencies, twitch, 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 twitch. It's going to, you know, kind of build up, right? If you go real high frequencies, what's going to happen? You know, you can reach what's called tetany, where you can't contract any higher than what you're doing. And it would be like if you started to lift a heavy weight, you might stop halfway. You just can't do it anymore, but you're firing the highest rate you can. That would be in your tetany, or tetanus, if you call it, for this. This is different than the tetanus toxin, which gets confused. We'll talk about that in a little bit. So this is tetany, where you develop this rapid tension at the maximum stimulation. So how is all this regulated? Back to the early chapters that we talked about. This is why you can't purge all that information, right? It all goes back to glycolysis, TCA, electron transport chain at the cell level. So what happens with all that energy, all that ATP that needs to be made to get that calcium back up, and all that work of the myosin heads, a lot of mitochondria. And so if you stained up muscle cells for any of those enzymes, let's say it's a muscle like in your back or your head, your neck muscles that keeps your head from falling over all the time. That's muscles are working all the time. Would you expect a lot of mitochondria or a few mitochondria? A lot of mitochondria. How many muscles that you might be using for jumping and shooting baskets, but then you get tired really quickly? Fewer, right? Because those are fast muscles, but they can't maintain it. You fatigue relatively quickly. The nerves that innervate those are similar too. They don't have as many mitochondria as, you know, the ones that are really firing fast and then relax. They kind of fatigue too. There's a little bit of fatigue at the neuromuscular junction as well. But fatigue is very hard to define, right? We talked about that before, right? You're running a marathon, right? And you're getting tired. And then you think you can't do anymore? Is it really the lack of ATP? Because all of a sudden somebody could come behind you and say, move it, move it, move it, and you can start going, right? So you just didn't happen all of a sudden. It's somewhat of a mental issue too. So that's why they get rid of the fatigue and experiments the mental part by taking the nerve in the muscle, testing it directly. But then if you stimulate the nerve, you could have synaptic fatigue. So that's why then you go to the muscle directly, stimulate that directly, and find out what's happening in the muscle itself. So this is why people then take that muscle, and they even divide that up. Like I mentioned, people over in physiology, they take out the contractile element, and they study the myosin heads binding to the actin, and they actually poke holes in the membrane, so they don't have a problem about the calcium uptake and calcium going in. So they poke holes in the muscle, and they put it in a bath, and then they quickly switch it to another bath, and they'll see it contract. So it's not even dependent on the calcium coming into the cell because they poked holes in it, so it's just exposed to the bath. It's like the endoplasmic reticulum is gone. So you see how people did a reductionist approach to understand how myosin heads bind and all that process. So it's pretty neat. We talked about before other aspects of energy like creatinine phosphate. Creatinine phosphate, right? Arginine phosphate. In some animals, like birds, will use, instead of lots of stores of glycogen they can have, but they can also use other energy stores, like creatinine phosphate. If you go to the health food store, you'll probably see bottles of creatinine that you can buy, creatinine phosphate. There's some reasonable response to it, but some of it's kind of hokey, you know, like lots of things, there's half-truths to stuff. So it's kind of neat. What if you didn't have a lot of mitochondria? What's going to happen? You're just going to use glycolysis, right? You're not going to get enough ATP, and your muscles can't keep functioning, right? So that's a problem if you're not making. Remember the byproduct. We're going to come back to this with circulatory system. Because to get oxygen, what do you need in your skeletal muscles? You need to get it to it, right? How do you get the oxygen to your skeletal muscles? Blood vessels, right? Just a prelude, think about the vascularization to slow muscle, ones that don't fatigue, versus fast muscle. Do you expect any difference? Right? Because you need oxygenation for the mitochondria. So all that goes together when we come back to the circulatory system. We're going to be talking about delivering this oxygen, but also getting rid of the CO2. Because what happens if CO2 rises? Perhaps the pH decreases, right? That tattoo that you need, CO2 plus water equals hydrogen plus bicarb, right? So now the pH is going to drop in here too. So this is going to be an issue unless you buffer that pH. Right? So all this comes together. Think about it all together. Oh, one thing. Did we ever mention about pure water and pH and temperature? No? We should maybe mention this here. We're going to talk about it when we get to osmotope. If you took water, we take it out of, let's get really distilled water, pure water, without any salts. And we have pure water here. We put a pH probe in it. Okay? And then we take that, and we have, okay, we divide that water up into three beakers. Here's one at room temperature. Here's one we have cold, and here's one that we have hot. And all the pH electrodes are all calibrated. Okay, we heat one up, we cool one down. Is the pH going to change in these? Pure water. How many think if we raise the temperature, pH stays the same? pH goes up. pH goes down. I don't care. No, okay, come on. All right, so, and if you cool it down. pH in water changes with temperature. But what's the equation that we all remembered? pH equals negative log of hydrogen ion concentration. Where's temperature in that equation? Temperature? No temperature in there. That's because that's not the full equation. It's times the activity coefficient. So pH equals negative log times the hydrogen ion concentration times the activity coefficient. That activity coefficient has a temperature variable in there. It's a disassociation of water. You disassociate water, what do you get? OH and hydrogen ions, right? Those hydrogen ions, well, what is that? That's your hydrogen, right? So the higher the temperature, your pH drops. The colder the temperature, your pH goes up. Think about the exercising muscle, too, right? Temperature's rising because of all the biochemical processes. So that, you know, you exercise, your temperature goes up locally, right? So that's an issue. You think about animals that are heterothermic, the lizard, right? Warming itself up. Well, now the pH, it has to balance that pH also with the temperature. So keep all this together. We did teach a group of high school science teachers about pH and water. About 1% got it right. All right, so this is an issue we've got to keep, you know, commenting on it. So pH changes with temperature and water. And this is why if you work in a lab and you're going to calibrate a solution that you maybe are going to use cold, right, in the refrigerator, or you're going to use it cold, and your pH buffers sit out, and you calibrate your pH electrode, but then you're going to use cold saline or something, your pH is not going to be the right. So this is why in some labs they store their pH calibrating solutions in their refrigerator or whatever temperature they're going to do their experiments at, because it's important to calibrate your machine the same way. Okay, so try to remember that one. Okay. Well, can you have a pH? What's your pH range? What's the pH range in the real world out there?
Science. Real world, right?
Understanding. 7.5. Well, 7.5. I mean, not just in us, but pH as a whole. pH equals negative log of hydrogen ion times that activity coefficient. What do people generally think about? Y'all had chemistry, right? Personal chemistry. Y'all finished all that stuff. Your pH range in the real world? Anybody have an idea? 1 to 14, right? That's what we all remember. Very good, thank you. Is that the real pH? No. Can you have a negative pH? Negative pH? Oh my God, I've never heard of it. What is a negative pH? How can you have a negative pH? What is the log of 10? 1. pH equals the negative log of the hydrogen ion. So if you had a 10 molar, strong acidic solution that disassociates, you got a negative 1 pH. And that's true. You can have negative pHs. We're in this mindset because of our instrumentation. So when Beckman created the pH electrode, that electrode that we generally use in labs only measures between 1 and 14. It's limited by that instrument that we use. There are streams out in California where the mining goes on that's negative 2 pH. Negative 2, because they use such strong acids like chromic acid and other things to get out the rare metals like silver and things. And they found out these streams were so, you know, low in pH. But somebody went out and saw, hey, there's this bacteria that's growing on this stream. They actually isolated that bacteria and tried to figure out what it was, and they actually described new species of bacteria that they never knew existed. I mean, here we're going to Mars, and we don't even know what's on our planet, right? So it's pretty neat to think about. Can you have a pH greater than 14? Yes, if you have a real strong base. So remember, always question things. Think about your limitations in your measurements, too. Really interesting. because new things come about that way. Okay, so if you divide up muscle fiber types, and generally there's lots of different fiber types. There's usually about five different types that we might talk about. But in general, for us, let's think about these three major groups, okay? You can get off into tangents and get into more subdivisions, but these three major groups we should at least know. And by the names, you should be able to figure out most of this. Slow, oxidative. Oxidative means what? Fast, glycolytic. Glycolytic means what? Glycolysis, right? So glycolysis without using oxygen, right? Oxidative means electron transport chain, which means a lot of mitochondria, right? So which is fast muscle, which is generally slow muscle? Well, slower muscle that can keep working all the time is going to have a lot of mitochondria. Fast muscle that's going to fatigue, though, quickly, because you can't keep using it, might not have much mitochondria, but it goes through the glycolytic pathway, okay? And then you have this kind of intermediate group. And you can, staying up, they're named by these types generally, type 1, type 2A, and type 2B. And you go through this transition in development of your muscle fiber types, and then you're pretty much set. And it's, a lot of it's determined by genetics. So actually, they don't do it so much anymore, but the Russians were really advanced compared to us in a lot of choosing kids for athletic training or for the Olympics. They would actually go through schools and biopsy kids' muscles and actually find out what type of muscle fiber type they have. So if you had a lot of fast muscle fiber type, would you want them to be a cross-country runner? Yeah, you're fighting the genetics. It's not going to work. But if you found out they had a lot of slow muscle fiber type, would they make a good cross-country racer? Yes. And so, you know, by looking at that, you could actually, you can't fight the genetics. If you're, you know, a good sprinter, you could actually look at their muscle fiber type and you're going to see that they have probably a lot of fast muscle, and but they're going to fatigue. They would not be good at the cross-country race, right? And this is what you see in the Olympics, right? You're not going to see those people switching between cross-country and sprinters. It's just not going to happen. So it's pretty neat to think about. People have thought of ways of transforming those, but they don't really transform even with exercise that well. There's some pretty neat studies where they did this back in the 70s. They took motor nerves in cats and other animals. They crossed the fast motor nerve, cut it, and cut the slow, and they switched the muscle fibers. So it would now innervate the other muscle. The muscle fiber would not totally change, but it would begin to start to change a little bit, but it wouldn't transform completely. So what does that tell you? Activity-dependent process, right? So it's pretty neat. If you think of even the gymnastics people, right? They're doing all those gymnastics, but as their muscles get bigger and bigger and they put on bulk, they actually lose a lot of coordination too. So there's kind of this limit about how much they can do before they're actually going too much, and now they can't really do good gymnastics on those balance beams because their muscle mass is too big and they can't balance well too. So that you see these trade-offs that are really quite amazing. But generally, then just think about slow oxidative. Look at resistance to fatigue, very high. Fast glycolytic, low, right? Just like we talked about, fast and slow. Rate of contraction, slow, fast, right? Enzymes for anaerobic glycolysis, right? So glycolysis, glycolytic, high, right? If you stand up for enzymes for mitochondria, where are you going to see more of them? In here, right? So you get the idea, and this is how they stain up muscle fibers. You can stain them in all different ways. You can stain for the mitochondria. You can stain for the glycolytic enzymes, or the enzymes in the TCA cycle, or electron transport chain. Depending on how you stain it, you can see these different fiber types. And you can actually then classify that muscle fiber, or muscle groups. All right, so it's kind of neat. And you can then, what would you anticipate? The frog muscle, you know, that jumps. Is it going to be a slow muscle or is it going to be a fast muscle? Fast, right? It jumps. And it can't keep jumping, it fatigues. So, yeah, it all fits. It's pretty neat. And so you can make these predictions, too. And you can actually see the range of the sarcomere and how that works within that animal for shortening quickly. It's not going to go really long. It's not going to go really short. But it stays in that range like we talked about before, the physiological range versus where you might get into an experimental range in like mammals and other amphibians. So let's look at a little bit of that calcium handling that we talked about, the rate of muscle contraction. Pretty neat. So when you talk about red and white muscle, or, you know, you go to KFC if they don't run out of chicken, and then you can get, you know, dark meat or white meat. What are we referring to in muscle?
Mitochondria.
But why is red muscle going to call like dark and white, or red muscle, red and white muscle? What makes red muscle red? If you looked at fresh muscle, you know, stepped open an animal, a mammal, quickly, it would look, if you take that muscle up and you take another muscle, it'll actually look more red than another muscle. What makes red muscle look red? Isn't that weird? What makes it look dark or white? Red and white, basically. Yes. So remember, slow muscle, lots of oxygen, right? Lots of mitochondria. So you get more vascularization. In a mammal, we use hemoglobin, right? More vascularization. So that could be one. But if you take the blood out, it still looks different than the other muscle. That's kind of neat. And its key is mitochondria. If you isolate mitochondria and you put it in a test tube and you looked at it in white light, it looks reddish. So more mitochondria makes it look reddish. But there's something else inside a muscle that's really amazing. It's called myoglobin. It's like hemoglobin. We're going to talk about it later. It's like hemoglobin, but it's one globular unit. So it's not a quaternary structure. It's a more or less like a tertiary type of structure, right? It's one globular unit. But it can bind oxygen better than hemoglobin. Now, why would we want to do that? Here's the blood supply going by the muscle. How are you going to get that oxygen out of the blood supply into the muscle? You need a diffusion gradient, right? And you're going to need something to pull it into the muscle. So one thing, you're using it up, right? You're using it up in TCA cycle, due to that, right? So you're using oxygen, so that's going to cause a gradient. But you want something to help pull it in there. And myoglobin is inside of the muscle cells. If you isolate myoglobin and you put it in a test tube and looked at it in white light, it will look reddish. So three general ideas. Increased vascularization, increased mitochondria, increased content of myoglobin. There's more myoglobin in slow muscle than there is fast muscle. Usually slow muscle is bigger, too, than fast muscle. So all those come together of why you have more red muscle versus white muscle when you look at this. All right. So let's look at some of this. This is what we think about red and white, too. This is just general. Don't try to memorize numbers, but the general concept. White muscle, as we said, fast. This is myoplasm. Calcium. So this is calcium on the y-axis, right? So it can contract fast and come back. To be able to contract again, you have to get the calcium down, right? Otherwise it stays contracted. You can't relax and come back. So the calcium has to come down fast. But in red, that's slow to do. So you can't keep contracting it really fast in red muscle, right? It's because the calcium hasn't come back. It's going to stay contracted a bit. But there's this other muscle that people found that's really quite cool. It's called the sonic muscle. This comes from a fish. That's what's called a boat fish, and it's the sonic because it makes this low vibration sound like, you know, and it can vibrate this muscle really fast to give that sound, so they call it the sonic muscle. And they found out it was pretty fast, but the real winner we can get to up here, let's go to this muscle, the shaker muscle. Where's the shaker muscle from? We talked about that. You saw that CNN article? The rattlesnake shaker. So to shake in the rattlesnake is amazing. This shaker muscle, 1.4 milliseconds for calcium to go up and come back down so it can beat again. And that's really fast muscle, right? So it can shake really quick. And it's temperature dependent, right? If you have it at a lower temperature versus a higher temperature, it can actually work a lot faster. That's pretty neat. Like I said, that rattlesnake changes its beating up their little tail depending on the temperature as well. And you can tell to stay away or you know, you're in danger or not by the rate of that shaking. Alright, so if we go back to this figure here, red muscles, you can see the force it generates, right? Every time you contract and relax, the calcium relates to it, so it's a very nice correlation together of that calcium handling. If we look at that sonic muscle, look at that rate. The calcium comes back down every time. And so the muscle can relax in between every beat, right? So it's pretty neat. All correlates very well together. Beauty of science all together nicely. All right. So that force development, like we said, relates to the calcium and the relaxation and the rate of stimulation. Okay, so then we jump on to some other muscle fiber types. I know it's speeding along here. It's like, God, are we ever going to stop? All right, but now if we talk about cardiac muscle. Okay, so cardiac muscle's a bit different. It's interesting because you can see the banding pattern in cardiac muscle. And it's important, right? Your heart is important, I think. Okay, so you want to understand a little bit about it, but we can't spend a lot of time. We could have a whole course just on cardiac muscle. Really neat. There's people over here in the muscle research group that actually works on this. So what's different about cardiac muscle? Cardiac muscle has these really good sarcoplasmic reticulum, but it also has intercalculated disc, and it has these junctions, gap junctions in between, right? You have electrical signals that can go down between on your heart, right? Carry electrical signals between one cell to the next cell to the next cell. So you don't need a nerve to innervate every muscle fiber, right? You don't even need nerves on your heart. You can cut all the nerves out of your heart, and your heart's still going to be, it's myogenic. We'll get more into that when we get into the cardio. This figure, I think it might be messed up on your PowerPoints online. If you first look at it, there might be a box over that right-hand side, the smooth muscles, because I was going to do it in a sequence. So watch out. If you pull up your PowerPoint, just click on it, make sure that white box is gone on the right side. This table, I know, it's a lot of information, but the best thing to do is take out a blank piece of paper, write out some three things, or four things. Skeletal muscle, cardiac muscle, two forms of smooth muscle, multi-unit and single unit. And then write down what you know about them, right? And what do we know about skeletal muscle? Everything that we just talked about, basically, right? Where does calcium come from in skeletal muscle? Sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Now, where does calcium come from in the heart? The sarcoplasmic reticulum plus something else. The plasma membrane has calcium channels, voltage-gated calcium channels. So when you depolarize the membrane, calcium comes in through the plasma membrane. This is why that is very important to regulate the calcium around the heart correctly. So let's look down this figure here. Source of calcium. Skeletal muscle, sarcoplasmic reticulum. Cardiac, ECF, extracellular fluid, right? Extracellular fluid outside the cell, and the SR, okay? And then for smooth muscle, we'll get into that in a little bit. That's quite different. Contraction of skeletal muscle. We know it's neurogenic, you have to have a nerve. The heart is myogenic. But does it have neural innervation? Yes, it has sympathetic and parasympathetic that we're going to talk about later. All right, so that's kind of cool. So go on through here and kind of get the idea of the different groupings for cardiac and skeletal. Now, smooth muscle is really quite interesting because there are groups of smooth muscle called multi-unit and single unit. But how to remember this? Not to just memorize everything, but how to remember it. Think of a single unit of all the muscle working together, all as a single unit. You have different muscle cells, but they all work together. How are they going to all work together? By having gap junctions between them, right? So now you think, oh, okay, they've got gap junctions. Where is this? Gap junctions, right here. Gap junctions. And multi-unit, different groups of the muscle cells are working independently. So they don't all connect together. So they don't have gap junctions all together. But then to work independently, what might they have? Neurogenic, right? Innervation. So that's kind of neat. And this is really quite cool. They're both controlled by this autonomic nervous system, which we'll get into a little bit later. Now, smooth muscle is smooth versus skeletal and cardiac because you don't really see the banding pattern of myosin actin like we saw in skeletal muscle. Cardiac does have sarcomeres, so don't get confused. People miss that on multiple choice. Cardiac muscle has sarcomeres, right? And you can see a banding, but it's not all nicely arranged like skeletal muscle. It might be in one group of this way, and another group of fibers are this way, and another group's kind of this way, but you can see the banding pattern. And it works the same thing that we talked about. Smooth muscle does have myosin, it does have actin, but you don't see the banding pattern, all right? So it still works with myosin and actin. But there's a whole kind of different process, and it's a little bit confusing sometimes. Good God. Okay. And that It still works, don't get confused, still works with myosin and actin, but it's not just that banding pattern, but it still works with phosphorylation-dependent steps. Okay, so there's still phosphorylation-dependent steps. But it's a little confusing because there's different ways that this works. I don't want to go into that depth of it, and you won't probably see those on standardized exams. But you do see sometimes smooth muscle, doesn't have actin, doesn't have myosin, because you don't see the banding pattern, don't be fooled. There's myosin and actin in there, and that's how it still interacts, right? And it can cause a contraction, just you don't see the banding pattern. Okay, so go through this basically and kind of understand the general points that we just covered. All right. And I think smooth muscle, multi-unit, single unit, if you understand that big concept of it all working together, then it all flows nicely. The other thing just to remember is that smooth muscle is like your cardiac muscle. Calcium comes from the outside sources. Okay? So smooth muscle, where is that generally? GI tract, right? Blood vessels, smooth muscle, right? Yes?
So why is speed of contraction for cardiac classified as slow?
It's not super fast, right? Compared to your... Yeah, think about like 70 beats a minute, right? It might go up to a little bit higher, but it's not going to be anywhere close to what your skeletal muscle can do, you know, really fast. But what do you want, too, with cardiac? Good question. You want those ventricles to contract with strength and slow enough that it can pump that blood out. If it goes too fast, it pumps really fast, but it might not have the strength to push against that high resistance that we have, too. So, and the action potentials are different. When we get down into the ventricular muscle fibers, we're going to talk about the action potential shape is different, which appears on standardized exams if you're already studying for the... So. Okay, so a little bit about skeletal muscle. It's just phenomenal. I put a link in there, too, if you want to know about the sarcolemma. It's a plasma membrane, just like cell membrane. It's got channels, it's got receptors, it's got all this stuff. But remember, there's like a lot of matrix outside of this, like we talked about, right, that holds this with connective tissue around it. So it's not just a contractile, it's not just, you know, a little bit of the SER. We talked about a lot of proteins that go in between the contractile elements, plasma membrane, out to the basal lamina, the base membrane that's around the muscle fiber. Okay, that's that stuff.
Okay, so there's some other things on the PowerPoint. We're not going to get into those things, but I wanted to do one fun thing here in a second. So we're going to get into something else. So we have a activity, and we have a guinea pig, and we promise it won't hurt too much, okay? It's kind of a fun thing. If you're ever, you know, torturing your cousins or relatives again in the summertime, it's fun to do. Let's see if I can get a... outlet here somewhere. I think this will work. My plug should work. And so this is a back massage. You can get these at Walgreens or Walmart. And it's really fun to do. And so it's a muscle massager. You could call it something else, but I won't say what else you might want to call it. All right. And so we're going to have this guinea pig come up here, all right, and try this out. It really is a muscle massage. Walgreens. Okay.
Hey,
so, and then just a little bit more.
Okay.
So we're going to stimulate right here.
Okay.
So what she's going to do, she's going to relax. And she's going to relax. Relax. And then she's going to close her eyes. And so she's going to try this first of all. You're going to touch your nose.
Okay.
No, this hand.
This hand?
Yeah. And then you're going to slowly go out. Okay. And slowly come back and touch the tip of your nose. All right, she did that pretty well, right? Yay. Now, I'm going to push up on her arm. This is going to work on her tendon. So she's going to start with it touching her nose.
Okay.
And then I'm going to push here, and she's going to have to push down a little bit.
Okay.
And now she's going to go away. Now, slowly come back and touch your nose. Oh, you did a good job. All right, let's try that again.
Okay.
She's too good. All right, real slow. Did it feel any different?
Slightly, yes.
What did it feel like?
I felt like there was more pressure that time.
Or did it feel like here?
Oh, doing it was like...
Yes. Was there any difference?
Just not a lot. It was a little bit harder.
Anybody else want to try too?
Yeah.
All right, come on. All right. Now, I thought it would work easier because your tendon should be fresh, but maybe I'm not pushing right on the tendon right. Maybe I need a stronger muscle massager. All right, so you got to close your eyes, and you got to touch your nose first. Yes, okay. And now I'm going to, I don't know, he's got a lot of muscle on there. So I'm going to, okay, touch your nose.
I have to keep pushing up. Now go out. Now slowly, 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 slowly come back.
I can do it.
Oh, you're pretty good. Yeah. Right at the tip. So, did it feel any different to you?
Just a little weird.
A little bit weird. So this is, and some people, we did this in the elementary schools, and they're like touching their head up here. And it's called Pinocchio nose. Because did your nose feel like it was longer to try to touch?
No.
No? Anybody else want to try? You can borrow this if you want. Just, you know. Okay. So, yeah, you can just try it. Give it a shot. Let's see what's happening. And maybe I need to increase this thing. Oh, there's different strengths to this. Now I figure this out. Okay. Right. So you can touch your necklace. And let me just hold this there for a little bit. Okay, now slowly go out. And slowly go back. Did it feel any different? Not really. Okay, I need a stronger one. Alright. But it works really well. So you can look it up on Wikipedia, whatever it's called. Pinocchio nose. It's kind of fun. But what's the key behind it? What are we doing? Stimulating the tendon, which vibrates your proprioceptors, which are your muscle spindles, right? So your muscle spindles, if you vibrate these muscle spindles, you can't really tell very well where your arm is, supposedly. I need a stronger thing. And so you can't really tell where it's going on. And so the idea is those muscle spindles are really important to understand your limbs and where you are in coordination. Okay, so some other things that we're going to do before we get into behavior chapter. It's already posted online, too. Let me see what we're doing here. Oh, I got lots of good things for you. Just to keep you motivated. Anybody ever read Sinclair Lewis? Aerosmith? No? Anybody ever hear Sinclair Lewis? Maybe? No? Okay. A good thing to read. If you're pre-allied health, I suggest you get Aerosmith and read that. It was written a long time ago, but really good. Okay. Aerosmith. It's not the music group. Oliver Sacks, really cool guy, Oliver Sacks. Remember we talked about him, the neurologist, like the man that mistook his wife for the hat? Did I talk about that? Right? You know, because he had the neurological problems. He wrote a whole book on the parietal cortex of disorders in the parietal cortex. He also wrote a book on migraines. This is really neat, too, because it talks about a lot of neurological problems, but in general, layman's type of terms. It's really super cool. Oliver Sacks. Okay, there's another book. Sean Carroll, hopefully you've read Sean Carroll. Brave Genius, he wrote a book called Brave Genius. It's really good. Right? Did you read it? Oh, isn't it fantastic? It's great. Two Nobel laureates he covers and talks about. One got the Nobel laureate in journalism, right? Or writing? Yeah, in literature. And the other one in medicine and health, right? And understanding how proteins are made, RNA processing and things like that. And those two got together, and actually it's a very interesting story, Brave Genius. By Sean Carroll. Okay, the other activity. Oh, yes, I have other activities. Remember we talked about hearing and sensory stuff? And here is a little insect. What do we have in this little cockroach thing? We have right here this big tympanic membrane. It's a thin part of the cuticle. What does it do with that tympanic membrane, do you think? Hearing, that's right. So it has to have some kind of reception in there, right? So it's really cool. In the inside that tympanic membrane, there's this little structure that attaches to it. So think of a membrane, a little structure that attaches to it, an elastic strand, and then it goes inside the animal. But what about the animal doesn't have bones inside? How can it? What does it attach to? Isn't that interesting? Remember arthropods? Exoskeleton. No, they don't have a skeleton on the inside. But they came up with such genius ways to have attachment points. Their cuticle can invaginate in certain spots. So there's a little invagination in the cuticle. It makes like a little finger inside the animal. And then it can attach to that strand and have like a little skeleton inside. So the strand goes across there. What's in that strand? Sensory nerves. So when that strand moves, it pulls on that strand, it activates stretch-activated ion channels. What's so cool about these tympanic membranes in an insect is that strand that goes on the inside, guess what? It's like your membrane in your inner ear. Low frequencies, high frequencies, right? So low frequencies, high frequencies. And you can actually pick up and record from these different neurons and give different frequencies, and you can pick up which ones it's picking up. It's no different than our inner ear on that kind of elastic strand in the way that membrane picks up low frequencies and high frequencies in different regions. So it's tonotopically arranged. Isn't that cool? The little insect, very simple system, just like your inner ear in there. So that's just so cool. Oh, God, the thing had something in there, secreted something. All right. There's another. This was the little locust. You know those katydids that are out there? And, oh, God, maybe I should put the light on it. That would help, probably. There's a little patch. Next time you see katydids out there in the spring, go pick one up. There's little patches of membrane right here, too. And it's the same thing. It adheres with it. Some insects have a lot more than others. So that's pretty cool. All right, that was that demo. Back to another demo, which we're going to start talking about animals and behavior. Oh, your favorite animal. Is that just not beautiful? All right. That is so beautiful. Look at that little beast. Those big black eyes. Aren't they cute? All right. So this animal is just phenomenal. We could have a whole course on just crayfish, but we'll keep going, I guess. Let's see what happens if we touch it on the tail. What did it do? Tail flipped. So it tail flipped forwards, right? And let's see if we can get this around a little bit. Come here. And we touch it in the front. I don't know if you saw that. We touch it in the front, it tail flips backwards. Pretty smart little guy. You can test to see if it's visual. You can put little aluminum cap, little aluminum foil, and wrap it around the eyes so it can't see, and just know if it's only by touch. Does it tail flip just by... And so that was backwards. And if we touch this tail, if I can do it, then it tail flips forward. That's kind of neat. And if we kept doing that repetitively, guess what? It would stop tail flipping. Whoa. Why does it stop tail flipping? Got tired right now. And then we waited a little while, like the next day, and we did it again. It would start tail flipping again. So what do we call that? This is habituation, right? Habituation to the sensory stimulus. Where's the habituation happening? Is it in its higher brain? Is it in the sensory neurons itself? Is it in the connections of the nervous system? Where is the habituation occurring? Is the animal learning this? If we cut some nerves, like to the higher center, to its brain, and cut it off, you know, so it can't have the connection from the tail, and we did this, guess what? As you did in your lab, when you dissected your crayfish, what happened to the tails when you pinched them? Sometimes a tail flip, right? And in your hand. So you stimulate those, you got that tail flip response. But if you kept doing it, it would actually habituate too, just in the isolated tail. So now you know it's not higher centers. But this is kind of interesting. If we took a big crayfish, ones that are really big like in your lab, and touched on the tail, it might only tail flip once. And then it's done. And it's going to try to, you know, pinch you, right? That's really odd, right? So why is it the small crayfish can tail flip many, many times and they don't habituate too quickly? That's neat. And then the bigger they get, they habituate really fast and they just want to pinch you. And that's kind of neat. And then this guy in the 1970s looked at lobsters and they did the same thing. And he took students from Boston University and he worked down at Woods Hole, Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, and he had these students working with these kind of projects. And he could take big crayfish, or big lobsters, you know, big claws, right? And touch them on the tail, and they don't really want to tail flip. But you take those big crayfish or lobsters, and you pinch on their base of their claw, what happens? They can autonomize, right? It's like that breakage point, special breakage point. So you can autonomize their limbs, and now touch them on the tail, and guess what? They start tail flipping. But we just told you it wasn't all necessary for the higher centers. But somehow that animal knows it just lost its claws and it starts tail flipping. But that process seems to be higher centers. So isn't that interesting? Now we've got sensory input that can alter the tail flip response. That behavior you just saw, the crayfish tail flip response, was the first behavior explained in animals from neuron to neuron to neuron. Don Kennedy explained that in the 1970s. It became so famous, he was the president of Stanford University for about 10 years. because at that time neuroscience was blooming and nobody really understood neural circuitry. This was a simple model animal. They could study from sensory neuron to an interneuron to a motor neuron and understand the whole neural circuit. They could recapitulate that in the dish. You could just take the neurons out and redo that in the dish. You don't need the muscles. You could record from the neurons. And then understand the habituation process. And they know that the synapses change. Isn't that wild? And so there's still people, there's a whole group of people that came out of Don Kennedy's labs and still work on this project. Psychology departments, neurobiology departments, all different kinds of groups that still work on this to understand the processes of synaptic plasticity, which is fundamental to our brain, right? And they use that model to understand the synapses. What's really quite cool is the sensory neurons that project to the interneurons, that's chemical. The interneuron to the motor neuron, there's actually gap junctions that can go to the motor neuron to stimulate the tail flip really quick. Isn't that kind of neat? That's what you want in an escape response, right? Fast responses. So they worked that out, and actually some of the first gap junctions, remember, I told you about Ed Kravitz at Harvard Neurobiology, he actually used the crayfish and the lobster and inject dyes into the neuron that connects to the motor neuron for those gap junctions to understand the size of gap junctions and what kind of compounds can go across, charge, non-charge, different sizes. And from that model and using that circuitry, we understand today the sizes of gap junctions that were tested in many different systems. But the primary work was actually done in these crustacean preps. Pretty cool stuff, right? Pretty cool stuff. Okay. So, I wanted to do some drawings and I get too much on a tangent. Okay. So, let's go with a little bit of this behavior and then we'll do some more stuff about muscles later. So, this chapter's already up there. I'm going to just kind of go through this really quick because this is somewhat gee-whizzy, but there's some real content behind this, and I'll try to emphasize some of the content. Like we just talked about, sensory, processing, behavior. If you don't have muscles, you don't have a behavior, right? Basically, so you know how important skeletal muscles are. And different types of behavior, fast, slow. You can't expect some behaviors to be really fast if the animal doesn't have fast muscle, right? So it's kind of interesting. And like we just said, past experience, right? And how this can change that circuitry. And this is where the field really is in neuroscience today, trying to understand circuits and how those change with time and all kinds of different things with it, right? How you can beef it up or depress it or control epilepsy or other different things. So simple circuits, receptor cell right to the effector, interneurons, right, or something that goes to another neuron that goes to that muscle, and then you can get more complex interneurons, like with the central nervous system. You go there from simple animals to more complex animals, and as you imagine, that nervous system becomes more complex. There's so many neat things in the nervous system, like animals that can detect a blood meal, for example. It can change the swelling, like I mentioned. It can close stretch activator channels or maybe open them. Just the general concept to understand, right? And it can change then the depolarization of the nerve terminal and change the kind of transmitter that goes out, right? So osmodetection, neurons, right, that stretch, relax, based on the osmolarity around, or maybe changing the ion concentration outside. This cell, generally, chloride is kind of lower on the outside, but if this animal, and we'll talk about it later, eats a meal and the chloride concentration raises, it changes the driving gradient. So then the chloride doesn't come out as much and it changes its activity. So driving gradient is so important in animals and around your nervous system inside your brain to detect osmolarity and different concentrations of ions as well. It's kind of really neat. Cells that can detect light. We talked about visual cells, rods and cones, right? And there's something else that's really interesting in other parts of your brain. There's these cells called the pineal in the pineal gland that actually is a sensor of light too. So the trout pineal site is in the pineal body and it can actually detect light and change its release of transmitter that we can talk about later when we get to that point. But the light can actually change it and decrease the amount of transmission. Where is this? The pineal gland, and here's the human brain. But remember, you can look at the brains of a fish, a reptile, a snake, amphibian, and basically the same process and the same architecture exists in the brain stem in a rodent, a lizard, a snake, a turtle, a bird, as you. And so there's basically the same structure here, the brain stem and what's going on. But there's this really neat part right up here in the hypothalamus region that regulates osmolarity and everything. This is your pituitary body. But if you go across the pituitary body and over here, there's the pineal body. But look at this big structure on top that grew over that area. But in birds and in fish, this big cerebral cortex is not developed that high. So actually the pineal gland sits right here, or the pineal body, they call it. Pineal body sits right there, and the skull's right over that. And guess what can penetrate that skull? Light. And so light hits it. It's called the third eye. Because in birds and in fish, you can actually entrain them by just putting light on the pineal structure. It's really quite cool. But in us, in higher primates, this cerebral cortex grew over it. But guess what? That pineal site, that pineal body still regulates a lot to do with your circadian pattern, sleep-wake cycle. And it's pretty neat. It has the same structure, but we lost that being sensitive to light anymore, or can't get light down in there anymore. So it's kind of neat to think about, and those processes. So we saw this brain generally in the labs that we talked about, cerebellum for motor coordination, cerebrum, you know, higher thought, if you will, on your exams, for example. And the simple nervous system, like in jellyfish, comb jellies, people just like, that's so weird because it looks like a nerve net like that, and you couldn't figure out how on earth does it have a coordinated, you know, swimming, right? How does it do that? Through this little nerve net. It's just wild. So people still study that to try to figure out how it works. Then some really beautiful preparations. Oh, one on the top, we could spend almost the whole course on that. The leech system, Haruta Medicine Analysis. They still use leeches today in medicine and health. Why do they use them for generally? Leeches? The blood-sucking leeches? Yeah, to increase blood flow. Let's say you got your finger cut off, a bandsaw, right? Sew the finger back on, or a dog bit your ear off or something, right? And you sew the finger back on, great. But what happens? You're not getting good blood flow to the fingertip, and it's going to drop off, right? So what they do is they put leeches on it. Put a cup over it, and it keeps the blood flowing through there, and it's going to save your finger or save your ear. So they still use these today, leeches. But the leech system is a phenomenal system. It actually is so phenomenal, it opened up so many areas in neurobiology, but we forget about it, and we don't appreciate it. And it actually was the first animal to really understand your glial cells and what your glial cells do. Look at this beautiful little thing. So if you look at this leech ganglion right here, this is the top one, you see it's in little packets. See little packets? Mm-hmm. And the leech is a segmental animal, right? It's an annelid, like an earthworm. Oh, I forgot, I had a model. Oh yes, I have a model. It needs feeding. I need volunteers. I'm going to volunteer. It's so beautiful. Oh, that little baby. Get off of me. Oh, shoot. There it goes. Over there, somewhere. Come on. There you go. Look at that thing. Isn't that beautiful? It's so beautiful. And, come here. Henry. Named it Henry. If you look at it, here too, look at it swimming. It can swim. Anybody want to get in the bathtub with that thing? Not really, right? But you see that undulation that goes on like that? The swimming behavior? Phenomenal. How does it swim? How does it know to swim? What's the swimming pattern? Motor, you know, reflexes working together. Sensory, motor, all coordinated in that simple little nervous system, right? Simple little nervous system. It's hungry. Oh, and they're very cute. I don't know if you can see it, but they have this nice red stripe on them. Come here. They have this nice, where do you see it? I don't know if that camera does it justice. But there's these nice red stripes on the back of them. They're quite pretty if you want to take a look at them. We go to little elementary schools and do leech things and let them see it. And then it's really bad. We went out to one in East Jasmine sometime and we showed leeches. And then I told them, you know, we brought out like five, but there's only two left. I guess three had escaped. They must have fallen off the table and got on your shoes or something. So all the kids are, you know, all day long. And so the teacher comes up at the end and says, all our kids are just going crazy about this. And we had a parent complaining about these leeches and because they escaped. And I said, oh, they'll find them sooner or later. But anyways, they never did escape. It was quite fun. Okay. So the leech system, if you look at it right before we stop here, annelid segmental system has 21 ganglion, and each ganglion has about 400 neurons. They know the name of every neuron in the ganglion. Every neuron has a name or a number in the ganglion. Is that not cool? Why do they do this? A lot of people study this. Why did the Navy study this, do you think? The Navy funded a lot of researchers to begin to do some of the studying. Because if you could understand how one neuron connects to the other neuron and has this nice undulation, what could you build? Robotics, right? Maybe the robotic leash, right? And there's a guy in Emory University, Ron Calabrese, and he actually records from these neurons in here, and he's had as many as, what was it I said before, some 22 or 25 intracellular electrodes. You thought it was bad with the big crayfish muscle? He has on his setup like 25 electrodes poking into all these different neurons, and he knows the name of every one of those neurons, measures the electrical signals, but what's really cool is he takes that leech, cuts open the ganglion, has that on a pedestal, has the tail sitting over here and the head over here in the fluid. He can touch on the tail and it will start to swim, and then all of a sudden there's just the ganglion there, and then the rest of the body starts to swim. So he can actually understand how each neuron connects to each other and work out the neural circuits of 20-something neurons at one time. And then he can kill one neuron at a time and see how it alters the neural circuit. And that's how they're actually understanding robotics or prosthetics for humans. Is that not cool? That's really cool. One other thing before we stop real quick. This ganglion, these little packets right here. See these little packets? These are glial packets. They're not microglia. They're glial packets. So they wrap around a whole bunch of neurons. They're little glial packets. So in the 1970s, John Nichols recorded. He put an electrode in that glial packet. So you're in the glial cell, okay? You're in the glial cell. Then he put another electrode inside the neuron. He stimulated the neuron repetitively, stimulating it, right? Depolarizing it. And he watched the glial cell intracellular electrode depolarize. Whoa! Why is the glial cell depolarizing? Goes back to your lab. Think of a lab exercise you did. What makes cells depolarize?
Potassium.
So, the activity of the neuron caused the glial cell to depolarize. And they think it's because of the potassium. The higher the frequency, the more depolarization. Whoa, that's the first time they've recorded electrophysiologically understanding what a glial cell's function might be in our nervous system, too. From that, a lot of work went out to try to understand epilepsy, because maybe it's a glial cell misfunction that could buffer the potassium, right? Because we have more glial cells in our brain than we do neurons. What do they do there besides just act like glue? So a lot of research went into that. Actually, the leech nervous system was one of the first model preparations to understand regeneration and repair. You can crush these. You can actually take a donor leech, take out a Ritzia cell, put that into another leech, into the ganglion, open up the capsule, and put it in, and that other donor neuron will actually grow and follow the other neuron's path to the target cells. You can crush the connectives, and it will regrow. It was one of the first models to understand regeneration and repair in the nervous system. So cool. That's the leech system. We'll start on the aplasia system down below next time. Anybody want to play with a leech? You can. But then we got to go to the muscle class. The muscle center.
Bonus points.
Bonus points. Did you feed him? I got a lot to feed. I fed him on my leg 1 year. It was a disaster. Because I got infected. And I was too embarrassed to go to the doctor. So I can't tell my mom what I did. I used my dog. Oh, yeah. It will try to.
You just had your hand.